I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, grappling with the pride and sometimes the self-hatred of an Asian American identity. We'll spend this hour with poet and author Kathy Park Hong, the daughter of Korean immigrants who spent her childhood listening to people mock her mother's accent and still braces herself for degrading stereotypes when Asian characters are featured in movies and on TV. We'll talk with her about the origins of the term Asian American and how it flattens the differences between people with roots in dozens of cultures, and about why the model minority myth is so troubling. Our conversation starts after a short break. Percent of people in the U.S. are classified by demographers as Asian American. But it's hard to say whether that term is a great fit to describe close to 20 million people with roots on a continent with 50 countries and more than half the world's population. What does it mean to be Asian American in the 21st century? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Kathy Park Hong is poetry editor at The New Republic and professor at Rutgers Newark University. As the daughter of Korean immigrants, she is deeply familiar with the sting of ignorant remarks and biases about her identity, and also with the nagging sense that somehow she doesn't have the right to complain because other racial minorities seem to have it worse. In her book of essays, she explores the ways her life has been shaped by the need to please white people in order to fit in or to get ahead, and also by her struggle to define herself for herself. Kathy Park Hong is a recipient of the Pushcart Prize, the Wyndham Campbell Prize, and Guggenheim and National Endowment for the Arts Fellowships. Her book is called Minor Feelings, An Asian American Reckoning. Kathy, welcome to Think.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me.
I want to start with this term, minor feelings. What does it mean?
Minor feelings is basically a set of emotions that I conceptualize for the book. It's shame, suspicion, melancholy, anxiety, all those fun feelings that one would feel when your reality is constantly gaslit by a dominant culture. You know, so this, in this case with this book, it had to do with growing up Asian and always feeling that my stories, my feelings were unacknowledged or dismissed. Any of the racial encounters I had were also dismissed. And a very recent example, I would say, is a lot of the anti-Asian racism that's happening now, even though there have been hundreds of cases reported per day, there's still a lot of Americans who don't think it's who refuse to believe that it exists. Like, I was on a radio show the other day where it was like George Takei was on there, and we were talking about the history of Asian Americans, and I was talking about the kind of discrimination and the harassment, and someone called in and he said, "I don't believe you. I don't think it's happening because I don't see it." Huh. And it's that kind of dismissal. And then, you know, and I growing up under that kind, being constantly dismissed like that, makes you just, you know, just makes you very frustrated, you know, about how your reality is unacknowledged.
On the other side of the coin, you write about an experience in which you were harassed, I think, while waiting for a train. You were the target of this race-based harassment. Your white friend was like undone by witnessing the whole thing, and suddenly the focus is all on her pain.
Yeah, basically what happened, I mean, this was a long time ago, and she's actually a wonderful person, but I was 23 years old. We were waiting on the subway platform. This young white man came down the stairs, and he turned to me and he said, "Ching chong, ding dong," or something, mm-hmm. you know, something very grade school. Mm-hmm. And I felt angry but uncomfortable. And I was with my two friends who happened to be white, and I said, "Don't worry about it," because I didn't want them to feel uncomfortable. And then I got on the train and he was there. And actually, you know, he's not, you know, he actually, he He had his wife there, who was black, and his child. And I just became angrier and angrier looking at him. And finally, I decided to say something. And I went up to him and I said what he said was very disrespectful and racist, and and that he was being a bad example for his child. And then I walked back, and then it was a very crowded train, and he came up to me and he said, and he was actually pointing to the guy who I was with. He said, "If this was your boyfriend, I'd beat the heck out of him." And then he walked back, and we were actually relieved that it didn't lead to more violence. And then, as I was getting off the train, am I allowed to curse?
No, please, please, we're live, so please don't.
Okay. So he said, he called me the CH word. As I got off, and interestingly, as I got off the train, these two people who are Indian got up and immediately stood up and said, "Hey, that's not right," So I got out of the train, and then before I had a chance to react, my friend, who is white, just started crying. She just started crying, and she just said, "That's never happened to me before. That's never happened to me before." And I, in the book, I write about how I suddenly felt like I was shoved aside, like I was not even the main character to my own story. I was again the sidekick who had to comfort my friend, even though I was the victim of this racist incident. And immediately following that, I talk about how, I talk about white fragility and so forth. So that's what that story is about.
How do you make a decision? And maybe the decision is different depending on the situation. You say that this woman is, in fact, a wonderful friend. I mean, how often do you decide at some point that it's worth talking to her and saying, do you see what you did there? And how often it's worth sort of understanding in the broader context that she is your good friend and she didn't mean to hurt you? I mean, when do you speak up to someone you care about to educate them?
I do it more now. I didn't do it back then. I was very young. She was also very young. I think she grew up a lot since then. But I think I internalized a lot of these microaggressions because I said, "Oh, it's not really a big deal, and I don't want to make my friend uncomfortable." So when I was younger, I just allowed it to kind of just, I just let it pass. And then as I grew older and became more confident in myself, I would, if it's a friend who would say something, I would, and if it's repeated, if it's not an isolated situation, especially if it's repeated, I would say, "Look, that makes me really uncomfortable, and I want to tell you why." Actually, that friend read my book. And she emailed me, and she said, she told me she read it, and she apologized for that incident. And I was actually quite grateful that she did that. I was afraid she was never going to speak to me again.
There is a pervasive stereotype that somehow all Asian Americans are thriving in this country. First of all, what role did immigration policy play in creating that myth?
What you're talking about is the model minority myth. That's a contrivance that was really became popular with the 1965 immigration law. Before this immigration law, immigrants from most from Asia, Africa, Latin America, most were not allowed into the US. And then in 1965, it was opened up. And suddenly, immigrants were finally allowed, especially non-white immigrants were finally allowed into the US. However, there were still restrictions. The only, at least, in Asia, the only immigrants who are allowed in were professional were professionals, those who are already trained as engineers or doctors or a few mechanics and computer programmers. So the people who came in were already highly educated, came a lot of them already came from wealthy backgrounds. And so they were already on a step above, say like immigrants now from Latin America and so forth, who come in fleeing dangerous government. So they were already doctors, and the model minority myth is a myth because what America's Americans would say, oh, look, this immigrant is able to live the American dream. This American became a do this immigrant became a doctor when the immigrant was already a doctor who's come in, So that's kind of the lie, this idea of the kind of bootstrapper, someone who come in with nothing, and then they end up becoming a very successful doctor whose kids all go to Harvard and Yale and all of that. And when in fact, they were already privileged by the time they were it led into the United States.
This leads us to the idea of how debt or gratitude are assumed to play a role in the lives of Asian Americans. It's a different sort of indebtedness for immigrants themselves than for their children and grandchildren, right?
Yes, you mean to this country?
Yeah. Like the sense that somehow immigrants should be grateful to America.
Well, it's a complicated question. I mean, I think this is what my parents felt, and this is what they have told me, that they are, but then they'll also complain about this country as well, that they feel grateful for having for getting a second chance in the US, and that there are job opportunities. And in turn, they would say, you should be grateful that we came here and that we sacrificed so much for you and your education. And I think this is actually a pretty common story that a lot of children of immigrants hear. In my book, I talk about how I wouldn't say all immigrants, but definitely say immigrants who come from Latin America or certain Asian countries like Vietnam, the reason why they're in the US was because of American interventions abroad, such as the Vietnam War or say the Korean War or say some of the American interventions in Latin America, so that their homeland was devastated, so they had no place to go, and therefore they were in America. So it's not because we make it seem like we're coming to this new country and we have all this opportunity, when in fact the U.S. has been responsible for wars. And also mining resources from countries that kind of devastated their land as well.
Is this something that subsequent generations of Asian Americans, those who are maybe the grandchildren or even great-grandchildren of immigrants, do they see their place in the world differently than those with more recent immigrant roots, do you think?
Do they identify themselves as Asian Americans differently than, say, first generation and second generation?
Yeah.
Is that? I don't know. I mean, I think they probably don't have, I think it depends case by case, and I really can't speak for them, for the Asian Americans who've been here for generations. I will say that they probably don't have the same kind of angst that I might, come having parents who are recent immigrants. But I will say that they're still considered foreigners, which is very odd, that they're still considered, unlike, say, someone who's of German descent who's been here for three or four generations, someone of Asian descent who's been here for three or four generations are still asked, where are you from and do you speak English? So they still are meant to feel like they don't really belong in this country.
My guest is poet and author Kathy Park Hong. She's poetry editor at The New Republic and professor at Rutgers Newark University. We're talking about her new book, Minor Feelings: An Asian American Reckoning. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes. listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is poet and author Kathy Park Hong. She's professor at Rutgers Newark University and poetry editor at The New Republic. Her new book is called Minor Feelings, An Asian American Reckoning. Kathy, before the break, you mentioned angst. There was a time in your life when you decided you wanted therapy. How did you go about looking for a therapist?
Went on Aetna. It was probably not the best way to look for a therapist, but I just went on Aetna and I looked for healthcare providers. And I actually wanted to first find a Korean American therapist because I thought finding a Korean American therapist would be better for me since she would know where I was coming from. So there was basically just one person with a Korean surname. I made an appointment. I had a consultation with her, and to my surprise, I just started crying and I just started telling her my life story. And afterwards, I felt quite cleansed, and I wanted to see her again. And basically, she tried to ghost me. I mean, afterwards, you know, she wouldn't return my phone calls. And at the time, I was very depressed. That was why I was trying to find a therapist. And, you know, I thought I needed help right away. And I left like dozens of voicemail. And she would call back, you know, I'd leave three messages and she would call me back. And then eventually she called me back and I was really excited. I think I was in, oh no, I was I in Texas at the time? I was like in LA on, I'm sorry. I was in Denver, Denver airport. And I was ecstatic. I was excited that she finally called me back. I was like a spurned lover or something. and then she told me right off the bat that she didn't want to see me. Like that we weren't the right fit. And I was shocked because I didn't know that therapists were allowed to reject patients like this. Mm-hmm. And then I demanded to know why. And she wouldn't tell me. She said, I'm not allowed to disclose that information. And that was even more shocking to me. And I said, well, I kept just demanding that she needed to tell me. Otherwise, I was going to think that she didn't want to see me because I was crazy, too crazy for her. And she said, obviously, that's not the case, but because she wouldn't disclose it, to this day, I don't know why she didn't want to see me as a patient. So after that, I didn't put this in the book, but I found another Korean American therapist, but I was so angry at the first one that I was like, I could tell I was like suddenly this petulant person. I was very petulant with her, as if I was taking out my resentment against the first therapist on her. And I think she was also quite new as well, but it didn't work out with her. And then I just randomly called up another therapist who's my therapist now. She's not Korean, she's Jewish. And she's amazing. I love her. And I've been seeing her ever since.
Why do you think it was particularly, maybe it wasn't, maybe a therapist of any background could have said, I don't think we're going to work out. But it sounds like this particular therapist sharing a cultural background with you, like hit home in a different way.
It's, you know, I don't really want to speculate as to why she didn't think we were the right fit, but this was a kind of a theory that my other therapist suggested, that maybe what I went through was a little too close to what she went through. And she thought that she wouldn't be able to maintain enough distance to be my therapist. So that's kind of the best theory I can think of. Cause it's not like, cause I asked this therapist, I was like, is there someone I know that you're seeing? Do we have a person in common? So it's not. And she said, no, that wasn't the reason. So I'm wondering if that's the case, that we were too close in a way.
I was interested to read that for a long time you made a point of avoiding writing about identity. What made you feel like this was something you should not explore in your work?
I don't want to say that. I mean, that was how I felt at the time when I was in Iowa. And I was 24 at the University of Iowa Writers Workshop. I was 24 at the time. I started writing when I was in college. And actually, I was not, it wasn't like I only read and wrote white writers, white writers and wrote about white people. It was that I think when I was in college, I was actually very politicized. I read a lot of Asian American writers and I wrote about my Asian American identity. After I graduated from college, I worked at the Village Voice. At the Village Voice, it was also very politicized. Race was talked about constantly. But then when I went to Iowa, it was like a regression. Like it was like mid-century America where the civil rights never happened or feminism never happened. And and it wasn't necessarily even the faculty. It was more just like the atmosphere of the program where I just suddenly felt very uncomfortable writing about race or talking about race. And I was young, so it wasn't also cool. It wasn't cool to write identity politics poetry or identity politics fiction. And unfortunately, during that period, I kind of fell under that sort of spell of what was cool, and I was realized that and to write about anything that had to do with your personal life was not interesting, anti-intellectual, pandering, all those. All of that. And so I was discouraged to write about that.
How much do you think about who you're writing for when you sit down to write something new?
I really actually try not to think about an audience. I just want to write what inspires me. I think about audience a little too early on in the process. I think it can be kind of paralyzing. So I would say in the beginning, like I write for myself, I write what excites me. And then later in the process, as I'm kind of developing a poem or developing a work of fiction or not, I'm nonfiction, I think, well, who, then I start thinking like, who am I writing for? I would say that Minor Feelings is a book where I guess I was really writing directly to people like me who've been through what I've been through. I'm writing to my daughter too, that she could re which she could read in the future. But it's also a book for everyone as well.
To the extent that you are sometimes, as you say, hesitant to use we to speak broadly about the Asian American experience, what makes that feel fraught?
I think Asian Americans are quite sensitive about the first person plural because we're so reduced. We're constantly reduced. We're constantly considered, people always mistake us for looking like other Asians. Even now with the anti-Asian racism, everyone thinks that I'm Chinese, for instance. When in fact, Asian American is a tenuous alliance of many, many ethnicities, Southeast Asian, South Asian, Pacific Islander, and there, of course, are Asians who are half Asians, or, and we're also, where I come from, as a professor is going to be very different from someone who is a dishwasher. Or someone who is trans, so it's very, so when I was using this we, I didn't want to impose upon other people's experiences and, prescribe another definition of Asian America that wasn't quite right for someone else.
When do you feel like that risk is worth taking or the work requires it?
When I use the we in my book, I use the we to invite others to tell their stories, to invite other Asian Americans to stand up, participate, speak up and tell their stories so that, and also disagree and join in on the discussion and disagree with what I might have to say, so that this we is a multiplicity of different voices rather than just one. So that was when I felt most confident using the first person plural. The way I use we, there's this poet, Nathaniel Mackey, who said it quite beautifully. He uses we a lot in his poetry. And he says this we is like it's a pronoun that kind of contracts and expands. You know, sometimes you could be in, sometimes a reader can feel like the sometimes a reader can feel like they can walk in this room that is called we, and sometimes a reader can jump out of this we. And that's how I always use the we. That's how I use the we in Minor Feelings. You know, it was not this always this one we. Sometimes we was when I was talking about we as Asian American, sometimes it was American, sometimes it was Korean American, sometimes it was just my two friends and I, you know. Yeah.
How did the term Asian American originate?
Asian American, that term actually was from the late 60s, 1968. It was a group of radical students, a group of it was in a group of Asian Americans, Asian American students from UC Berkeley who decided to who came up with that term because they didn't want to be called Oriental. They wanted to, that was the only term that was being used. Otherwise, Asians were referred to as Vietnamese or, you know, Chinese or Filipino by their specific nationality. And they wanted to come up with a term that was also, that involved, that was pan-ethnic. And it was also a political term. They didn't mean for it to be a neutral term. They wanted Asian American to be an oppositional identity that was an opposition against the racism they were fighting during that day. They were also using that term as an opposition against the Vietnam War and all, you know, and the hundreds and thousands of lives who were dying there. They were it was a movement. There was a huge Asian American movement in the late 60s and the 70s that were largely forgotten by mainstream America.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So, to the extent that that movement, that kind of radical politics behind the term, has been forgotten by the mainstream, do you feel like the goals of the people who came up with the term have failed?
Oh no, I would not say that. I mean, I think, you know, there's been a lot of progress. I mean, it's hard to say. I think back then in the late 60s, everyone was really quite idealistic, not just Asian Americans. This was a group that was very much aligned with Black Panthers and really borrowed from their ideas and really wanted to create a multiracial, anti-colonial coalition. But I think some of that energy was perhaps forgotten at some points. There are so many Asian American organizations, so many Asian American activists throughout the years who have fought for decolonization, for refugee rights, for you know, for representation. But I don't think that there was that same kind of, it was never a movement quite in the same way that it was back in the late 60s. And I would say even, you know, there was a period of life time, you know, when I was younger, that Asian Americans really didn't think that they who didn't believe that they had a right to be politicized or radicalized. I think it's changing now. I think the younger generation especially is very, very politicized. And they're also not only fighting for the, not only are they anti-capitalist, anti-racist, they are also trying to build coalitions with other minorities and interrogating the anti-blackness within Asian American communities. So there is a lot happening now. And I think a lot of that has been, is due to the activists from the past, like Yuri Kuchiyama.
You write that the privilege of assimilation is that one is left alone, which is not the same as having power within a society.
No, it's not. I think, and it can change on a dime. This is why this model minority myth is a lie. Now, I've been talking about my experience as an East Asian, but take, for example, South Asians. South Asians are some Hindu South Asians are some of the highest earning highest earners among Asian Americans. But then after 9/11, they were attacked, they were harassed, they were asked to leave the country. There were lots of threats, hate crimes against South Asians, and Muslims, of course, went up. This one South Asian man in Seattle was shot at in front of his driveway because they thought he was Muslim. So it just, you're never really quite comfortable when you're assimilated, because this model minority myth can turn on a dime. It's like you are, it's basically being allowed to be invisible and being allowed to be, you're not under surveillance in the same way that a young Black man would be under surveillance, but that can change. And it's changed again for East Asians under the coronavirus. We thought, that at least we weren't under surveillance, that we can just go about doing our work. And then now we're targets.
My guest is poet and author Kathy Park Hong, poetry editor at The New Republic and author of the new book of essays, Minor Feelings, An Asian American Reckoning. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest, Kathy Park Hong, is professor at Rutgers Newark University, a poet and author and poetry editor at The New Republic. Her new collection of essays is called Minor Feelings, An Asian American Reckoning. So I would like to talk, Kathy, about this weird moment where we have this surge of anti-Asian racism because there are people who somehow blame China for the coronavirus. I mean, do you find yourself sort of braced for bad treatment when you have to run to the grocery store or the gas station or whatever these days?
I am in Brooklyn, so I'm less scared than I was, I would say, 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago. Or, as I wrote in my New York Times article, when I went outside wearing a mask for the first time, I was very scared. I thought I had a target on my back because a lot of Asians were definitely being harassed, but the Asians who were especially being harassed were Asians who were wearing masks. And in fact, there was at one point where there was a delivery person who just whizzed past me on his bike, and he called me a Chinese bee. But that was really the only incident. I do feel nervous. Yes. I mean, maybe not so much in my neighborhood, but like if we are, in the city, if I'm anywhere outside my neighborhood, for whatever reason, which is very rare, I am nervous. And, I would be nervous about leaving New York as well and going to any other town. I mean, the frightening thing about this COVID-19 and the racism is that it could happen anywhere, at any time, from anyone. You just don't know.
Do you mind if I ask how old your daughter is?
She's five.
She's five. Okay, so little still. I mean, are you trying to have conversations with her about these things? Are there things that she has noticed that have surprised you about people's perceptions of you and of her?
I don't talk to her about the anti-Asian discrimination, but her identity definitely comes up. I mean, it was there even from when she was a very young child. You know, we try to instill in her from a very young age, we try to instill in her to have pride for being half Asian, and she actually identifies as Korean, and she sounds very proud of that. She's like, I'm Korean, I'm Asian, and I have a lot of Asian friends. So she's definitely aware of race, but it's more just it's more a badge of pride than anything else.
All right, I want to go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Robert is calling us from Flower Mound, Texas. Hi, Robert.
Hello. Hey, I have a question about the identity and how do you deal with, we're Caucasian, adopted two South Korean children while we were stationed in the Air Force in South Korea during that intervention, as you call it. So how do you deal with that identity if you are Caucasian or different race raising an Asian?
Thanks for calling.
How do you raise your child if your child is a Korean adoptee? That's how I understand your question.
I think that's correct.
Yeah, I would say this woman, Nicole Chung, wrote an amazing book about being a Korean adoptee. And I would say read that book, because I think she would probably give you a very that book would give you a very nuanced answer to your question. And it's the book is called All You Can Ever Know. Because I don't see how I can answer that in just a little bit, and especially since I'm not a Korean adoptee. But I would say it's very, very important to acknowledge the child, your daughter or your son, if they say they feel different or they say they feel like they don't belong. It's very important for them to participate or learn more about their heritage, and to really encourage them to do that. I think it's most importantly, it's very important to listen to them, and to not dismiss whatever problems they may have about feeling disconnected from their culture.
You got interested in stand-up comedy as an art form for a while and would perform comedy at poetry readings. What drew you to this as a means of expression?
It was actually around the same time that I was looking for a therapist. This was a period of time when I was depressed. I was just finished with my second book of poems, and I was trying to write, but I couldn't. And part of it, I was feeling very discouraged and very cynical about poetry at the time. I thought that a lot of the poetry audience was very white, and I thought that I had to write a certain way to gain success. And that way was writing to a white audience, kind of diluting my experience, not being very upfront about my anger. But I didn't really know where to go, how to express this anger. And then I was watching Richard Pryor's live in concert for the first time, and it was a revelation. It was his stand-up comedy was more honest than a lot of the books I was a lot of the books by minority writers I was reading at the time. And that rawness, that bravery, that honesty, and also his humor was what was really inspiring, and actually was what eventually led to the writing of this book.
One of the things you did to really understand him and sort of inhabit his language was to transcribe a lot of his sets. What did you notice when you compared his words as written with what they sounded like on stage?
Well, as anyone who's watched Pryor would tell you, 80% of his talent, his genius, is how he embodies his humor. You know, it's all about the timing, it's all about his facial expressions and his impersonations and how he moves his body across the stage. I mean, that's what makes his comedy routine so hilarious. But when you transcribe it, when I transcribed it, what I found was that when you don't have his body, you don't have his voice, you don't have his facial expressions, the actual writing itself was actually just very angry, you know, and very grim, and sad too. You know, there was less, it was not as funny as it was when I saw it live.
I wonder if that's something that his audiences have, especially his non-Black audiences, have overlooked over time.
The anger?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, the first time I saw a Richard Pryor, Richard Pryor in anything was in a movie called, I believe it's called The Toy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a movie where he played a rich white boy's toy. And it really saddens me that that was my first, and I saw it when I was a kid, and it really saddens me that it was my first exposure to Richard Pryor. And I, you know, towards the end of his life, he just decided to sell out to Hollywood and make his millions just playing these roles. And I think a lot of maybe not people who aren't Black associate Pryor with those really bad movies. But instead of his comedy, which is very, of course, revolutionary and hilarious and, you know, artistic. So that's probably why there are many sides to Pryor.
You write about there are certain jokes that he does where he sort of compares white women with Black women. How did that cause you to think about your own place in that continuum or that binary or however you want to describe it?
I didn't think about it at the time, but then as I was watching it again and again, I mean, he's always, I mean, that's a comedy cliche, you know, to talk about the difference between Black people and white people or Black people and white people. And I was thinking, well, where do I belong? Am I, you know, if I'm not Black or white. And so, you know, when he was making fun of white people, I would laugh at white people, you know, but then sometimes I realized that I was actually allied with white people, which made me uncomfortable. But, you know, in the essay, I talk about what, you know, about the fact that I was an Asian American woman watching him and finding it hilarious and finding him really relatable. And what does that mean? That I was not Black or white. I was not immediately someone who could identify with him or someone who was his target. But instead, I was this other person, this Asian American who thought he was, who just immediately connected with him. And then I thought about why. Why did I connect with him? What was it about his comedy that made me not only laugh, but feel his pain so deeply? And it was actually in that essay that I started, I was talking about minor feelings, you know. Another definition that I don't, about minor feelings that I didn't articulate earlier on is that minor feelings are the feelings that you have when you're stuck in a racist capitalist structure, that you're stuck in a racist capitalist structure where you can't move up, you know, where you're stagnant, you know, and this is something that African Americans are quite familiar with, such as say police brutality and, you know, and not making enough progress with the judicial system, you know. So I kind of tried to dissect that connection.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We have a tweet here from a listener who wants to know if you feel that tending to white people's fragility is necessary to protect you from them.
tending to white people's fragility.
Like,
I don't tend to white people's fragility. I have no time to tend to white people's fragility. I don't have the patience for it. I'm not really sure what is meant by tending to white people's fragility. I think it's more important to me, for me, is tending to building Asian American consciousness and bringing upon bringing awareness to Asian American consciousness to others, and trying to kind of build bridges between people of color. That is more of a priority for me. But I might be misunderstanding the tweet.
Yeah, and I'm sorry that I can't give you any other context, because that's all I have. before we go, and we just have a short time left, you said you've chosen to write sort of nearby your Asian American experiences. Can you talk with that about what that means?
Basically, that was a quote from Trinh T. Minh Ha in an interview that she did for Art Forum, and she was talking about the subject was cultural appropriation, and how it's a subject that comes up again and again in the classes that she teach, where her students are very worried about making a film about another culture in which they don't belong to. And she said, instead of thinking of it as making a film about another culture, think of it as making a film nearby that culture, and that way you can be very transparent about where, how, you know, your role in filmmaking, and how you and how much you might not know about that culture, rather than having this kind of totalizing pretending to know everything.
Kathy Park Hong is poetry editor at the New Republic, professor at Rutgers Newark University, and author of the new collection of essays, Minor Feelings, An Asian American Reckoning. Kathy, thank you so much for making time to spend with us today.
Thank you.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter at KERA Think. Subscribe to our podcast by searching for KERA Think wherever you get your podcasts. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.